Ever since I got bit by that spider, I've only had 1 week where my life has felt normal. That was when you found out.
When you botched that spell where you wanted everyone to forget the Peter Parker Spider-Man, we started getting some visitors. From every universe.
Hello, Peter.
You're not Peter Parker.
I'm sorry, what was your name again?
Dr. Otto Octavius.
Wait, no, seriously, what's your actual name?
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and this is a special jam-packed episode of the Film and Water Podcast. We're going to be talking about Spider-Man No Way Home, a movie that literally everyone on the planet has seen by now. We have an all-star panel to talk about this movie. We have, from the network, Chris Franklin. Hi, Chris.
I don't want to brag, but I will. I was in the Avengers.
What are the Avengers?
Is that a band? It sounds like a band.
Ryan Daly?
If you spoil the ending of this movie, you will need a really good lawyer.
And the network's own Samuel Goldman, big-time movie producer, Corey Musa. Hi, Corey.
Hi, guys. Woo! Glad to be here.
We're very happy to have you here. This is so exciting. We're going to be having a genuine movie producer to talk about. What, this is like the third biggest opening movie of all time or something like that, where it's already passed $1 billion, 12 days in or something like that?
Yeah, I think it is today, right? It brought in like, it's Sony's highest grossing movie as of today.
Unbelievable. Wow. People
single-handedly
love
keeping their movie studio afloat.
Yeah.
Seriously, man. Oh my God. So, okay, we have a long conversation to get to. It's going to be a lot of fun. Before we get to that, we have to thank our sponsor. This episode of the Film and Water Podcast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 45% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. Ryan, what did you bring?
I brought Spider-Man by Roger Stern Omnibus. This is one of those giant hardcovers that if you drop this out a window, you will need a good lawyer, blind or not, because you're going to be facing a lawsuit based on what happens. This whole stuff, tons of Spider-Man stories. It's about 60 comics worth of material in this, mostly by Roger Stern and John Romita. Mighty Marvel presents Roger Stern's celebrated 1980s run on Spectacular Spider-Man and Amazing Spider-Man in one sensational omnibus, paired with John Romita Jr., that's what I meant to say, the Jr., and a host of other top art talents. Stern reinvigorated the friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, crafting definitive battles against the Juggernaut, Vulture, and Kingpin, the fan favorite tale of The Kid Who Collects Spider-Man, the debut of Monica Rambeau, woo, aka Captain Marvel, and the introduction of the Hobgoblin. And Peter Parker's social life grows complicated as well, with the Black Cat, Amy Powell, and Mary Jane Watson all vying for our hero's undivided attention. I'm not going to list all of the contents. You can check it out. But yeah, it's something like 60 comics in there. The page count is 1,296 pages. For the actual retail price is $125. But on in-stock trades, you can get it for 38% off, $77.50. These are great stories by Roger Stern, who's probably the second best Spider-Man writer after Stan Lee. And you can take Andy Leyland's word for that, because I'm pretty sure he agrees. Mm-hmm. Good stuff there.
That is some high praise, and that is a whole lot of Spider-Man.
unsurprising... You're going to have somebody crack your back after you lift that, I think.
Exactly. Unsurprisingly, my pick is also Spider-Man. I went with Spider-Man, the Newspaper Strips, Volume 2. This collects all of the Spider-Man daily newspaper strip that's ran. It collects the strips from January 1979 to January 1981. It features the dailies plus the Sundays, which are reprinted in color. This is only 312 pages. It's pretty much nothing compared to 1,200 pages of the Roger Stern book. But I used to love this strip. This was one of the kind of the last things I can remember reading in the newspaper before I stopped reading newspapers entirely. Sorry, everybody. But anyway, the Spider-Man newspaper strips, volume 2. The cover is by John Romita, not Junior, original crispy flavor, John Romita, written by Stan Lee. The normal price is $34.99. In-stock trades price is $21.69. That is 38% off. So between those two books, you can get something like 1,500 pages worth of Spider-Man. So for these and all your other trade paperback needs, visit instocktrades.com, and we thank them for their support. All right, guys, let's talk about Spider-Man No Way Home. I do want to give a warning to anybody listening to this. We are not going to bother with a pre-spoiler section where I'm going to assume at this point that if you're listening to this show a full 2 weeks after the movie has come out, that you have seen this movie. Virtually everybody in at least America has. So we're not going to worry about whether you've seen the movie or not. If for some reason you have not seen this movie yet, pause and come back and listen to, go see the movie and then come back and listen to this episode. Now, I want to just start off with everybody with a quick round robin question. I want to kind of get a phrase I use as a baseline for where everybody is. And we're going to start with you, Corey. In terms of the MCU movies, where have you been, or where are you on the two Spider-Man movies to this point? Do you think they're like top tier Marvel, middle tier Marvel, lower tier Marvel? And where do you rank Tom Holland as Spider compared to the other Spider-Man?
Oh boy, I'm so glad that I get to start this. I love them. I love the Marvel Spider-Man movies. I think that all three of these Spider-Man movies have been pretty awesome. And I think Tom Holland is probably the most accurate Peter Parker that we've gotten out of, you know, the other, out of all three Spider-Man we've had. So yeah, I mean, I'm like kind of consistently impressed with what Marvel continues to do, what Warner Brothers has such a hard time replicating. And, you know, Spider-Man is such an iconic character that everybody knows so well. I think he's maybe more well known than like Superman is now, or Mickey Mouse for that matter. But like, they do him justice. They really do. So that is my nutshell opinion. I'm a huge fan.
So you were looking forward to this one. Like, you were thinking this, you know, you liked the previous one, so you were really excited about this one.
I was really excited about this one, yeah. I mean, I was excited because I saw that it was going to go into the multiverse, but like, I would have been excited if it didn't go into the multiverse too. I don't think I would have been as excited. I'm not sure the movie would have grossed, you know, all this money if it hadn't gone into the multiverse.
Right, right. Okay. Ryan, what about you?
I've enjoyed the MCU version of Spider-Man. A lot of part of it just thinks like it, when he showed up, and I'm including his first appearance in Civil War II, it felt like such a palate cleanser, because the previous incarnation, the Amazing Spider-Man with Andrew Garfield, had some really good elements to it, but the movies themselves just felt really dark and dour. But so did the Sam Raimi trilogy. Like, I counted that, like, out of five Spider-Man movies that preceded the MCU version, four of them ended with Peter Parker in a graveyard at somebody's funeral. I was like, okay, I know death and tragedy are kind of central to the character's origin, but can we move on? So the fact that we kind of glossed over Uncle Ben, we didn't have to deal with that. We were just kind of getting a fresh start. And then with Homecoming, it felt a little bit, it just felt more fun. He was more youthful. He was more spirited. He wasn't bogged down by the sense that he caused the death of a loved one. So I really liked Homecoming for that reason. And it just felt like a fresh, new, young injection of energy into Spider-Man when I needed it the most. I thought Far From Home was not great. It was entertaining. I think the sequence when Mysterio goes full on Mysterio is one of the best superhero Spider-Man scenes in any movie. But other than that, I thought the movie was just kind of okay, lower tier Marvel for the MCU. But I was excited to this one because I was just kind of hoping for a return to form. But I also, I was nervous about this one, and I'll touch on that in a few minutes after Chris gives his answer, because I thought this one could have been disastrous for a couple of reasons.
All right, perfect segue, Chris.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this series of films from the get-go. I liked Tom Holland's take as Peter Parker in that first scene with Robert Downey Jr., you know, where he's in his room and he basically, you know, outs him as Spider-Man. I really, you know, the other films, I like aspects of them. I still think Spider-Man 2 is like one of the best, you know, superhero movies, you know, especially at the time. There's been so many since, but it still stands out. But I really liked Holland's take. I liked, even though they changed a lot about the character in some ways, and, you know, they you know, emphasized his high school friends, and, you know, he had a Ned to talk to, and then later he had an MJ. They switched it up a lot from the comics, but they had already done two different Spider-Man franchises at this point, so I think it was risky. I know there's some people that don't like the fact that they made those changes, but I really enjoyed them. I really got invested in the characters, and they are some of my favorite MCU films. They really are. I mean, they're fun, you know, and I feel like they've done a good job of letting Peter grow, and we definitely saw that in this one. So I was really, really excited for this one. My son Andrew was like super mega excited about it, and he and I just kept talking about all the different rumors that were going around. Who's going to be in this film? Who's not going to be in this film? Yes, they are. No, they're not. Oh, this looks like this is a real photo. I mean, I think Andrew like saw the trailer, watched the trailer more than people have examined this as a Pruder film. So we were really all psyched to go see it, but you know, we would have been psyched anyway, but we're just mega psyched by what it seemed like where they were going, and they actually did go that way. So.
Gotcha. As for me, I think Tom Holland is my favorite Spider-Man. As Corey said, I think he's the closest to sort of what I see in the comics. He does have the advantage of being part of the Marvel Universe that the other two guys didn't have. That's not their fault. But I mean, I always enjoy Spider-Man as part of the greater MCU, and getting him to see him interact with the other heroes is such a huge plus that I think he can't help but just come out ahead. That said, and I loved him in Civil War, and I loved him in the Infinity War and Endgame. That said, his solo movies I have found to be a little underwhelming. Both of them, I kind of, even with the first one with Michael Keaton, who I love, both times I just went, okay, those were all right. Like, I feel like they never quite got Spider-Man. And I'll get into one of the reasons why later on, why I was so kind of slightly dissatisfied. I don't think they were like the worst of the Marvel movies, but they were, to me, mid-tier at best. And I was excited about this one because I had heard certain things, obviously, but I wasn't going into it like, say, the way I did the third Captain America movie. Like, I thought the Captain America movies got better as they went along. And the Thor movie, like, you know, I was excited about Ragnarok. It's like, oh, it really seems like they're changing direction. But for Spider-Man, I was like, all right, I'm going to see it. But I'm not, if it's more like the other two, I'm going to kind of walk away with the same reaction. So I was a little more hesitant about it than probably anybody else. So that's where we are on the Spider-Man movies. Now, again, before we get to the general discussion, Ryan, you have some opening remarks?
Yeah. Just wanted to talk a little bit about the audacity or the ambition of this movie, and why I was nervous going into it, because why I thought this one might just fall flat on its face. Because there are a lot of reasons why on paper or in a pitch meeting, this thing just should not have worked. To start with kind of getting into the bolts of it, like the previous Spider-Man movie, Far From Home, ends with Spider-Man's identity being outed, not just to some people, but to the entire world. This movie decided, okay, the first thing we have to do now is, like, the plot of this movie hinges on trying to put that genie back in the bottle. And the source that they went to is using a magic spell to make everybody forget. So they kind of, in part, are borrowing from a familiar and very notorious story in Marvel's recent past, which is the story One More Day, which is in the comics about 15 years ago, Spider-Man outed himself during the Marvel Civil War event. And then because of his identity was public, Aunt May was almost killed. And in order to save her life, he has to make a deal with the devil. And then there's all these repercussions. But so basically, they're going to One More Day, which is one of the most, not just polarizing, but one of the most hated stories among Spider-Man fans. a story that the writer J. Michael Straczynski wanted to take his name off of the material, a story that only the editor-in-chief Joe Quesada could draw because nobody else wanted to, according to some stories, maybe just because he wanted to take ownership of it because it was his push. So if you're drawing your movie's inspiration from a story that diehard Spider-Man fans loathe because of the repercussions of that story, that's gutsy to name one thing. Another aspect of this movie, it requires them to take a supporting player in Doctor Strange, who is now a fan favorite and kind of beloved character after his inclusion with the other Marvel movies, and it goes right up to the line of making him look either inept or just badly out of character, so much so that people are coming up with speculation just based on how he sounded in the trailers. That's not the real Doctor Strange. That's got to be Mephisto, because it's always Mephisto. Or somebody has taken over him. Somebody's beguiled him, because the real Doctor Strange wouldn't be that stupid. I mean, if you're making him look that out of character, potentially bad, it's like, that could be dangerous for your movie if you're damaging other characters. And then the biggest thing now is the whole conceit that we're bringing in, we're going to join this movie with the previous Spider-Man franchises, the Tobey Maguire trilogy and the Andrew Garfield duology. These movies that had not been part of the MCU, we're now going to incorporate them in through this whole multiversal thing. Well, that might work, but remember how and why those franchises ended. Spider-Man 3 was a bad movie, and you might get people defending it. And if you go on Twitter, you can hear people saying, you know, they want Sam Raimi to make the fourth movie the way he was going to. But I was there. I saw Spider-Man 3, and it sucked. It was a bad movie. Every character in that movie had a crying scene, including Harry Osborn's butler. Like, the movie was bad. And then and Tobey Maguire was like 2 weeks away from making the fourth one with Sam Raimi when they cut his knees out from under him and cast Andrew Garfield and said, nope, we're going to do a new universe, a retcon and everything. And they bring in Andrew Garfield, and then his movies aren't great. I mean, Spider-Man 2, Amazing Spider-Man 2 is really, really bad. And Andrew Garfield was a great Spider-Man, I think, but the movies weren't good, and they failed for a couple of different reasons. And I know he always wanted to be in the MCU, and that was kind of a promise, but they didn't. They cut him off and recast him with somebody else too. So to say that we're going to reach out and we're going to bring these other Spider-Men and their characters into this world, these other Spider-Man movies left a bad taste in their mouth. They're like the lasting sting of these movies, the last image of Garfield's Spider-Man and Maguire's Spider-Man were bad movies, and the actors had good reason to kind of be pissed at Sony about the way that they were cut off and fired and replaced. So all of this stuff kind of commingling is like this movie, No Way Home, sounds like a whole bunch of bad ideas, but Marvel Studios being what they are and their partnership and their working relationship with Sony, they have been able to make some miracles, and they have been able to make silly ideas like a rocket with a machine gun be the most emotionally empathetic character in a movie. And they have been able to take something like Civil War, which was not a good comic, I didn't think, be an amazing movie. And I think they did it again. Somehow they know this magic formula where they had just the right amount of fan service to paint over a story that was weak and had some flaws, but enough to make a movie that was just fun and enjoyable and kind of like put a magic spell on the audience and make them think that this was a whole really good time at the movie theater. So yeah, I'm constantly impressed by Marvel in this case, just having the ambition to do something that should not have worked, and it makes $1 billion in a week. It's incredible.
Yeah. That would be nice for anybody to produce something that makes $1 billion in a week. You know, that would be a nice thing. Corey, I want to ask you, what was your what was your just initial impression of the movie? Have you only seen it the one time? Ryan, you've seen it twice, right? And Chris, you've seen it twice?
Yeah.
Okay, Ryan, Corey, where are you on this?
I've seen it twice. And
I'm the only one here that's only seen it one time. Okay, bad, bad.
Oh, I mean, give me an excuse to go to the movies, please. I just loved it. I thought it was really awesome. And I mean, I think what Ryan is saying is absolutely right. It had a ridiculously tall order to fill. It doesn't work on paper. It's kind of crazy. And they had to get so many working pieces in order to make this movie that it's kind of dumbfounding to think that they actually were able to pull it off. But I think if you look at the movie, and if you think about Marvel, the way that Marvel kind of works, Marvel's got a lot of money. Sony's got a lot of money. They can spend absurd amounts of money making something that maybe you normally wouldn't spend, which kind of gives them the luxury to rewrite the movie as they go along while they're making it, while they're filming it. If somebody has a better idea after they shoot it, they can kind of do a cut, an initial cut, and move the pieces around, and then they can go film some more and shoot something they hadn't really anticipated. So I think if you look at this movie and you break it down into three acts, the way that this movie works, I think there was an act of this movie written. And depending on who said yes to whatever they were reaching out to and what they were trying to do, the movie could have actually taken quite a few different shapes. The third act of the movie where we get Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire, like, to me, that actually felt like there could have been a completely different third act to that movie where those two guys don't show up whatsoever. There could have been a totally different second act of the movie. The first act of the movie, call it like the fight with Doctor Strange. The second act of the movie turns into the Sinister Six moving into the Spider-Verse and kind of coming into play. I think that that whole part could have been rewritten. I think they could have filmed the whole first part of the movie and, you know, they could have gotten Alfred Molina to sign on and then Jamie Foxx, and then one after another, they all kind of came into play and they write that act. I'm speculating, but knowing kind of what Marvel does, I think it's safe to say that pulling off something this ambitious, they had to stay open-minded. They had to stay open to changing what they were working on in order to kind of accommodate what they were trying to do. And again, this is all of the reasons that Ryan pointed out. This should not work. You're trying to cram way too much into a small story here. It shouldn't work at all. This story is supposed to be a sequel to the other Spider-Man movies, to the other Marvel movies. It also happens to be a sequel to Sam Raimi's Spider-Man movies. It's a sequel to Andrew Garfield's Spider-Man movies. It's crazy how many sequels this movie is.
It also successfully kind of reboots the character at the end of it by taking him back to his roots, not just in form of what fans kind of know and think about Spider-Man and his look and his modus operandi, but giving him a new origin with a new take on the Uncle Ben power and responsibility speech, but coming from a different direction. And actually kind of like at a crucial time, because I think if you look at the difference in the way this Spider-Man has acted, you can see it's because he's been young and it's because he's had Tony Stark as his guiding voice or Nick Fury or something in the other movies. Like, this version of Spider-Man has behaved recklessly and irresponsibly. He needed that speech that we never heard him get in this universe. He needed Aunt May to say that, and he needed that tragedy. And I think, well, I mean, Toby actually points it out. She didn't die for nothing. Like, that was a crucial thing to go back to in the story, to tell the origin anew in a way.
Yeah. I think this movie, you know, this movie in story level and meta level is a lot. It's about second chances, you know. Obviously, Tom Holland's Peter Parker wants to give the villains a second chance. You know, he's not comfortable with just letting the villains die. We'll forget that he says instant kill mode in the end game in the battle. That was war, so we'll give him that. So you know, he's all about redeeming the villains, but this movie also redeems Toby and redeems Andrew, and we can kind of forget dancing Peter Parker meme because now Toby Maguire is the cool youth pastor, and Andrew Garfield, and damn it, Andrew Garfield got to save MJ, you know, and what a moment. I mean, in the theater, the first time I saw it, everybody went nuts. Everybody went nuts when those two guys came through, you know, hoops and hollers and everything. It was great. But I mean, yeah, this movie really did, like Ryan pointed out, it in no way should have worked. And in fact, I mean, you know, at the way that Far From Home ended, you know, everybody was like, okay, there's Skrulls at the end. So it's got to, they're going to use the Skrulls to fix, you know, Peter, his secret identity problem, you know, or it's going to be something like that, right? Now, whoever thought when that movie ended that we would get the movie we got here, you know, and they kind of breeze through a lot of the legal ramifications, but you don't care. I mean, that alone should be like, wait a minute, you know, that part of it, I mean, the public opinion of Spider-Man goes, the back and forth about that doesn't go away, but the actual legal troubles go away at least for a while. And
I that's mean, what I'm talking about, Chris. I feel like there was a different first act they could have made to this movie. There could have been another hour of him in, it could have been a courtroom drama. It could have been 12 Angry Men with Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And then Alfred Molina and Jamie Foxx sign on and they were like, scratch the Charlie Cox thing. Let's do this instead. That's what it felt like. They breezed over that really fast. I was like, oh, look at all these huge ramifications that like we're all going to have explained away by Charlie Cox's cameo and him catching like a stone being thrown through a window and saying, I'm a really good lawyer.
I personally would have loved the 12 Angry Spider-Man movie. That would have been great. 12 guys all pointing at each other and stuff. So, I mean, one of the things that I was troubled by when I saw the first trailer was that they revealed that like all this gets started because of Spidey messing with Doctor Strange's spell. And when I saw that, I thought, oh, they're clearly not explaining all of it. They're going to come up with another better hook than that Spider-Man just messed it up, because that seems a little flimsy. And then I was like, no, that's actually what they're going with. And some other comic book movies like the first Suicide Squad, and I think even Shazam, have this problem where the heroes are only solving problems that they themselves created. And that to me doesn't make them very heroic. I'm like, well, had they not created the problem in the first place, they wouldn't be there to fix it. Well, I don't, you know. And was anyone else bothered by that? The whole movie, yes, all this good stuff got to happen, but it was only because Peter Parker screwed it up. That doesn't feel super heroic to
but
me.
You know, for me, it was like Peter didn't screw it up when I was watching it. I was like, Doctor Strange screws it up, and then he blames it on Peter, which is actually like a remarkable thing that he holds on to that. Like, he never lets it go. He never accepts responsibility in this, which actually seems in line with the, you know, the Doctor Strange that they've given me in this universe, that he would be arrogant enough that he wouldn't apologize. So it really felt to me like Peter was cleaning up Doctor Strange's mistake, and he thought it was his own mistake, but the reality is he was cleaning up Doctor Strange's mistake.
I kind of see that. I kind of also think, you know, Doctor Strange does say this shouldn't be happening. It's all ramifications from Sylvie killing that version of Kang. You know, I mean, it goes back to Loki. I mean, I think the implication is the spell probably wouldn't have been botched nearly as badly if the multiverse wasn't already cracked, you know. So I think that's all, you know, everything's been building in what if, and, you know, clearly we're building to the multiverse of madness. And apparently the what if Doctor Strange is in the movie as well, you know, so.
But do you think that's a weakness of the movie, that they are referencing something on a TV show? Because what if people haven't seen that?
I don't think you have to read that into it. It's a bonus for people.
Right. Yeah.
You know, to me that are following everything Marvel. It's not, you're not really missing anything. It just adds to it. And I will say, you know, I've heard some people say, well, Doctor Strange, you know, Ryan brought up, he seemed out of character in the trailers. Maybe it's Mephisto. I went back and watched all the scenes that Tom Holland's Spider-Man are in the other, in the, you know, Civil War and the two Avengers movies as well. and just yesterday actually, and because I was sitting around like, oh, I'll just watch those, and you know, Doctor Strange is very, you know, of course he says, you know, I won't hesitate to let, you know, to Tony, let you and the kid die to protect the Time Stone. And then, you know, Doctor Strange also is like totally, he knows that the one reality where they win is where Tony dies. That's why he has to give Thanos the Time Stone and not kill Tony in Infinity War, because he needs Tony later to do the snap and take him out. So he can be a cold SOB in some ways. So him being like, yeah, no, if they die, that's their problem. You know, that's just fate and that's the way it's got to be. It totally reads with me with this version of Doctor Strange. Now you could argue maybe it's not the comic book version of Doctor Strange, but it reads with Cumberbatch in my opinion.
Yeah, I think this Doctor Strange is a very arrogant character. I think he would try to do a very dangerous spell if he thought it would help out a kid who he kind of sees as like a war buddy, a compatriot. And he as much as says, I forget that you're just a kid after everything that we went through. But again, the spell got screwed up, as I said, because this version of Spider-Man is very reckless and irresponsible and thinks for himself first. And you're right, Rob, that I think part of it is this is a hero who is just cleaning up his own mess at first. But halfway through the movie, Strange gives him the out. We can send these guys away and fix the multiverse. And Strange seemed, and that was another one of my problems. I was like, okay, you're sending these people to your death. That does seem kind of cold for a doctor who, like, with the whole primum non nocere, first do no harm type of thing. It's like, but he is looking at it from a much, much, much bigger picture. He's looking at trillions of lives and the multiverse. But I think, Rob, that, like, this Spider-Man does have a point in the middle where he's like, no, I'm not just covering my own ass now. I'm not just fixing my mistake. I can make things better. I can give these people a second chance. I can save their lives, change their fates. And that's what May tells him to. And then when it all goes wrong, he thinks he made the mistake, but the whole message is, no, this is the point of it, is to do better, that nobody should die because of Spider-Man. So, Rob, I think you were right at first, but I think the movie meets that head on and says, yeah, he's not just cleaning up after his own mistake. He's making it better. The fact that he sticks around and like cleans up the electrical towers after he knocks out the power grid.
That's fair. I do want to say, I caught myself thinking this while I was watching the movie, in that, like, you know, I think about, and we've talked about this on other episodes of the show, but like, I saw Batman Forever in the theater, and I remembered, you know, the one line in that movie where, you know, where are you going? The circus must be halfway to Metropolis by now. And like, I levitated out of my seat. I was so excited at a single reference to something else in the DC universe. And I just thought, this is the best it's ever going to be. And now I've lived long enough to go to a movie where Spider-Man, when he has a problem, can just go visit Doctor Strange. That's a thing that's in movies now. You know, like, woo! That used to be the purview of Marvel team-up, and that was it. That was where I had to go to get something like that. And now, you don't even have to explain it. Peter Parker can just get his map out and be like, oh yeah, I'm going to head down to Greenwich Village and go to the Sanctum Sanctorum. And everyone in the audience is totally on board with that. It's just, I never want to lose that wonder that's a thing Marvel has brought us, that we're all so comfortable with that. And Corey, I wanted to ask you, related to that, Corey, you mentioned that Marvel, for being this monolith, you know, huge rolling thing that it is, has to be kind of light on its feet in terms of being able to shift the films based on availability, who they can get, who signs on. And I have read this, that like, Marvel, at this point, when they make these movies, they build into their production schedule and their budget X number of weeks of reshooting. That's just standard now, which is not very unusual in movie making, correct?
Yeah, no, that is, I can confirm that is 100% true with Marvel. Like, I know that's what they're doing. And yeah, they plan after they finish shooting, they plan on major reshoots. And I shouldn't talk about this all so much, but it's crazy. It's something you can only do if you have a real lot of money. It's like an ideal situation for a filmmaker. It's the most artful way that you can make film, which is that you don't have to follow the strict plan that you laid out at the beginning to complete your movie, but instead that you could have the luxury of getting through something and saying, you know what? I have a better idea. I think it would work better if we tried to do this. Why don't we do this? And then that you can gather everybody you need and all of the resources to just go and do that. It's irresponsible filmmaking. It's a huge waste of money. But as a filmmaker, as a director, as an actor, as an artist, oh, wow, that's so cool. Like, wow, we can make something better than we planned on, which we never really do that because it'll cost us so much money to just stop what we're doing in the middle of it and just do something entirely different. I think this is why Marvel has pulled out like quite a number of surprising hits where something shouldn't have worked, because I think they've stayed really flexible in terms of what they're making. And I don't think that they necessarily finish exactly the way that they intended to when they start. That's all.
I think part of it, like that also, it factors in the type of filmmakers that they sign on and the director. So many of their directors from the like phases 2 and 3 and beyond have TV backgrounds. They're directors who are used to working collaboratively or part of an assembly line, like a journeyman where they come in. Like the fact that Doctor Strange is being directed by Sam Raimi, I can't think of another director of his stature and pedigree to work on one of these movies before Marvel launched these directors into the stratosphere, since Kenneth Branagh in the first Thor movie. Like most of the directors are either they've only had one other movie, like John Watts, who did this one, had one other movie, and they're like, Marvel's like, okay, they know how to tell a story with compelling characters, and we'll let our second unit team do all of the magical razzle-dazzle stuff. Or they're directors with TV backgrounds who kind of like know how to work in this efficient machine that they have kind of created. So,
I mean, I would say that, look, I think Sam Raimi is just gets it. And he is he's a player, like, and he's going to get along with that team, that infrastructure that he needs to make that, where some other directors, like somebody like Kenneth Branagh, for example, you know, when he came on to direct Thor, and there really wasn't a Marvel Cinematic Universe yet, and there wasn't this idea about how unified all these movies were going to be. He just wanted to make the best Thor movie he could make with his roots in Shakespeare and in theater. And like, I think that was probably the first of it. It was probably a lot of stuff coming from Kenneth Branagh that totally didn't really fit into a greater picture of what they wanted to do. But at the time, they just didn't know that yet. Like the directors didn't realize that they were going to be part of this much larger machine, that the machine was going to have a reputation longer than their individual films that they directed were going to. So,
well, that's also why you get somebody like Ava DuVernay or Edgar Wright kind of bowing out and saying they're not interested in this type of process.
Yeah, because, well, they don't get director's cut. It's not their movie at the end of the day, but I'm kind of okay with that because it's Marvel. There's something about it where it's like, I want there to be something holding it all together and not just being able to be destroyed by a singular voice that wanted to do something so radically different than its predecessors that it doesn't fit in with the rest of it.
Yep, so, I kind of feel like the Eternals, because it was so disconnected from the MCU, it kind of feels like those early Marvel movies more, you know, because it has that kind of more auteur kind of feel about it, you know, that early, like, this is the ground floor. It doesn't, and I enjoyed that movie, but it does kind of have that early Marvel MCU feel about it, which I guess and I think it's not only because they're new characters that haven't been introduced in previous movies, it's because the feel of that movie is a little, I mean, all the movies have a different flavor, you know, obviously, you know, Ant-Man's heist movie, these are more like, you know, they're almost like a John Hughes superhero fusion in some ways, but that Eternals movie did kind of have that kind of totally different feel to it. So I just, they just,
yeah. And that's probably, you know, that was Angelina Jolie is probably the largest star to come into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, or one of the largest stars to come into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I haven't seen Eternal, so I don't want to talk poorly of it, but it just felt like that movie had players in it that were bigger than Marvel could handle and that Marvel would suffer from it. I mean, it feels like you tell me, Chris, it's like, I read something about the other actors were like intimidated about doing their scenes with Angelina Jolie. You know,
I don't know, kind of the way the character goes in the movie, it kind of works that way though. So I don't want to spoil anything for you, but it kind of works with that character, I guess, in some ways.
I would be intimidated riding in an elevator with Angelina Jolie.
agreed.
It's kind of amazing that, you know, either by hook or by crook, that the Marvel movies now kind of really replicate the Marvel comics in terms of the Marvel comics universe allowed singular visions, but only so far. Like Steve Gerber, you know, he could go so far with Howard the Duck, but not too far out. Or Frank Miller with Daredevil, he could go too, you know, but then they would, yeah, but it's still got to be within the Marvel universe. Meanwhile, over at DC, they were allowing for all kinds of crazy voices that didn't have any connection to anything else anybody else was doing. And that's how the movies are now. You know, it's like over at DC, we're going to have a Joker movie that's going to have no connection to any of the other movies. Fine. You know, that's okay. But Marvel, it's all got, even within Chloe Zhao doing Eternals or whatever, it's all got to kind of stay within a certain realm of Marvel MCU-ishness, kind of. And so that's, I mean, and yeah.
So impressive. It's just so impressive to me. It's like, yeah, DC, you know, cranks out hit or misses every now and then. And some of DC's hits are arguably the best movies that there are, but some of their misses are arguably like the worst movies that there are, where Marvel has this consistency the past, you know, decade, and nobody's done this in film before. Nobody's made a series of movies that interconnect like this. I'm so impressed by it. I'm so excited to see how it's able to continue growing. What the Marvel Cinematic Universe might look like at its 20-year anniversary mark, at its 25-year anniversary mark, how big it's going to get, how many of the characters are going to have come to life. It's crazy to me that they have actually done this and they've done it successfully. Like, it shouldn't have worked. It, like, none of this should have worked. Iron Man should not be everybody's like favorite household like named character. It's crazy to me.
When the MCU turns 25, they're going to introduce the new universe with Starbrand and Kickers Inc. and DP7. it's clearly where they're headed. So in the second act, after Doctor Strange gets involved and whatever, and we meet all the villains show up. What did everybody think of that? Because when they all showed up, I was excited that they all showed up. I'm like, cool, we get like five villains. I was a little sad that Paul Giamatti didn't get to show up as the Rhino. He must have been like, hey, you know, what am I, chop liver over here? But like when they all were hanging out essentially at like the apartment, Happy's apartment, I was a little like, what are we doing here? Like it felt a little, really? We have the Sinister Five and they're just hanging out at an apartment. I know that's it was headed somewhere, but I did feel at that point I was like, where's this movie going? It seemed a little, did anybody else have a problem with that, or am I
got scared in that moment. Actually, I got particularly scared in that moment at Happy's apartment, because it's when I noticed that they left the lizard in the truck, and I was like, oh, this is a CW move. This is like, we can't make this look good. We're not going to be able to do a CGI lizard, put it in a really well-lit apartment in Happy's apartment. Like, he worked in the shadows in the prison when he's first introduced, and he works again in the dark in like all the fight sequences in Act 3, but they didn't know what to do with him in this part. And it was right at that moment. And it's like, it's weird for some reason, while this movie was really, really good and the money, they looked like they just had a money flowing that didn't end. The special effects on the lizard and Sandman were questionable. they looked kind of cheap. So I don't understand. After we've seen something like Thanos, where it works super, super well, that the lizard was like a part that really was kind of corny to me. And I thought it was going to move into really corny territory, Rob, when we got into Happy's apartment. But then there's that switch that happens in the apartment when Peter's tingling spider senses go off and William Dafoe's Green Goblin kind of switches personalities and goes bad. And it gets really exciting. And it kind of goes in a direction that I didn't think was going to happen. And then, you know, that basically propels us into the third act. So yeah, I was with you. I got scared in that moment. There were other moments I was nervous, but the movie always seemed to rectify itself.
Right. Chris, where were you guys on that?
I thought it kind of fit with the kind of young perspective that, you know, Peter and Ned and MJ thought they could actually, you know, like help these guys. And I just thought it fit in with the Holland Spider-Man films that they would take this approach and like bring them over to, you know, their apartment and try to cure them. I thought it was kind of, you know, kind of lighthearted. It was like, you know, Secret Six Real World or something for a little bit there, you know. But Sandman and Lizard both, I mean, honestly, they were obviously the periphery. I don't think the actors like returned to have any new footage filmed. I believe that's like either footage from Spider-Man 3 or cut footage from alternate takes from Amazing Spider-Man, when they revert back to their human form. So I don't think they were ever like on set to what I've heard. I mean, they did the voices, but I think they could have lost him. Maybe not Sandman, because you need the exposition for him to tell both Doc Ock and Green Goblin, hey, you're both dead. The best thing, though, and I mean, this movie's about redemption in a lot of ways. And they even redeemed the costume department for the original Sam Raimi Spider-Man, who covered up Willem Dafoe's face. My God, look what they did. Look at this man in this movie. He is the scariest damn supervillain ever put on film in this movie. I'm sorry.
Oh, man, I so agree with you, Chris. I thought it was the biggest tragedy in the Sam Raimi movies that, like, that stupid mask was on him. And, you know, he just looks like he is having so much fun, and I'm so glad that William Dafoe got to do this character again, and I feel like he got to do it right. I feel like when you see Green Goblin and he's got like his hood up and he's riding on his glider, and I was like, it's the Green Goblin. It's actually the Green Goblin. A Green Goblin that I never quite got in Spider-Man, and it was close, but it was never there. And that mask was such a huge part of like that mask was a real disaster. I agree.
Yeah. I mean, they took care of the Power Ranger problem. He even smashed it. They even like, this sucks, and we're going to smash it on film. And now we're going to show you what the Green Goblin can really look like by using a really great actor who was really great in the role otherwise. And he's going to scare the living shit out of you, because he did. I mean, he was frightening. I mean, and obviously what he did was just heart-wrenching, you know. And our buddy Andy Leyland, he always says Doc Ock is Spider-Man's number one foe. I'm sorry, I'm a kid from the 70s who grew up with a lot of toys and Spider-Man product. I saw Spider-Man fight the Green Goblin in person at a Hills department store. The Green Goblin is Spider-Man's number one nemesis, and they finally pulled off a hell of a battle between the two on screen. So
they should have worked that guy into the movie, the Hills Spider-Man movie.
At least Nicholas Hammond. Where's Nicholas Hammond?
I had that in my notes, Chris. I was like, what? I had read that they apparently wrote a part for him, and then the part got cut.
Oh,
and that's just like, come on. He's still around, you know, come on. And not only is he still around, he's active. Like he's in, he's in stuff. He was in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood just 2 years ago. So like he's still around. So I'm hoping that in Spider-Man 4, he will get another chance, because he deserves to be included in this. Just as a side note, growing up watching Willem Dafoe in Platoon, I saw that movie on cable 50 million times. If someone had said to me at 15, that guy is going to play both the Green Goblin and Vulko from Aquaman, I would have said, you are high. Get the hell out of here. That's never going to happen. And yet, here we are. So, Ryan, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Where were you on the villain? I love this, the real world Sinister Six edition. That's great. I'm going to just refer to it as that from now on.
Yeah, when I was 15, I was watching Willem Dafoe and Madonna in Body of Evidence, and I would have had the exact same response to picture him as Green Goblin.
Wearing candle wax on Green Goblin.
I agree with Corey that I got nervous when they went back to the condo, and it was because I think for me, Happy's condo is sort of emblematic of what's wrong in the first half of the movie for me. Like, the first act, I didn't really like. I mean, like the cameo with Matt Murdock, that's great. Like the energy of the kids and everything like that. But just, like, the pace, the structure, all of the stuff that's going on the first half hour, I'm kind of like, oh, this feels really messy and I'm not digging this. And then once we bring in the villains, once we see Doc Ock and there's nothing more beautiful as a fan to just watch Spider-Man and Dr. Octopus fight on film. And the way they did it in this movie just reminded me of how great the Spider-Man 2 battle looked back in 2004, which was amazing. Mm-hmm. That battle still holds up so well. That's just so good. But then, yeah, once they get back to the condo the Happy May like romance thing, it was just annoying me more than anything. But so once they go back to the condo, and I agree with Corey, like the fact that they left Lizard in the van, I was like, oh crap, that means they didn't trust what it looked like. But what salvages it is just the characters and seeing them interact and having Sandman and Electro being able to talk to each other and joke about what they happened to fall into that gave them these superpowers. It's kind of crazy. I knew that everybody was talking about Willem Dafoe and Alfred Molina and Jamie Foxx coming back. So I was kind of thinking, I was like, all right, are Sandman and Lizard just CGI? And I think Chris is right that they only lent voice work, but I was really happy to actually hear them talk. Once they started talking, I was like, oh, this actually, they're not just background characters. They're not going to have as much development. They're not going to be as important to the story as Goblin is. But they're not just throwaway characters. They actually have personality when the Lizard is talking, because the Lizard is one of my favorite Spider-Man villains. And to have him, to actually take the time to have Rhys Ifans come back and give it a little personality to this character, I'm like, that was redeeming. And that was the kind of fan service that carried me through the parts of the movie where I was like, no. The destruction of Happy's condo when everything goes bad, and that battle and everything, when Norman turns and you see the full Dafoe really kind of come out and take over. Like, it was weird to realize, like, I was in my chair watching it when I was like, I feel like the movie just came together and it's an hour into the movie. Luckily, there's another hour and a half to say this, because I was I recall like feeling at the part, I was like, now I think I know what the rest of this movie will be, and I'm here for it, because the first hour to get me to this place was shaky. But yeah,
I think we see the full Dafoe in Lars von Trier's Antichrist. I'm not sure. I think I heard that. You see that in that. Speaking of Sandman, and Corey, you can either speak to this or not, because I can understand it might, there might be some things you don't want to necessarily address. But I'm always kind of curious about what it's like securing actors down. Now that we're doing these decade-long reboots or side boots or whatever you want to call them, I always wonder what it's like to try and get back an actor who at the time that they did the original piece was hot, and in those intervening years have cooled down. And like when, like, and specifically I'm thinking of Thomas Hayden Church, like when they got him for Sandman, he was just coming off of Sideways with Paul Giamatti. And like, he had gotten an Oscar nomination, and all of a sudden he was like this hot commodity. And in the 15 years between those two movies, or however long it's been, he has cooled way down. And I kind of always wonder, like, does Marvel, like, how much arm twisting does Marvel have to do? Because on the one hand, you could see somebody like that saying, hey, I'm the guy. If you want me, you got to pay. At the same time, I could see Marvel saying, you know what? People are coming to see Spider-Man. They don't really care if we get you get you specifically, Thomas Hayden Church. We'll get somebody else from Wings to do the voiceovers for the Sandman.
Yeah, Tim Daly could have definitely done nice work there.
Why does Sandman sound like Superman suddenly? Yeah.
I don't know. I actually thought about that. I looked up Thomas Hayden Church after I saw this because I was like, what has he been doing lately? Like, I kind of don't even remember anything since Spider-Man 3 came out. But I don't think it's about money. I feel like it would have been no problem to pay those guys whatever they wanted if it was about money, like to get them to come to be in the movie more. I think that they were just secondary characters at the end of the day. That, like, the beautiful thing about this is that it was able to use the previous Spider-Man movies to create the backstory in a lot of ways that these characters, these villains, are all very developed by the time that we get them in this movie. We don't have to go through an arc with them. They already had an arc, and we're starting with a much more developed character. And maybe Sandman was just never that developed to begin with. Mm. Like, there wasn't anything there to work with. And if they needed to pull a third villain from Spider-Man 3, Venom was off the table. And I think that, like, they weren't going to put Hobgoblin in here because it would have fucked up what they were doing with Green Goblin. And maybe James Franco's not so popular right now. Mm. But, yeah, that's what I think. And I think that I can only guess that, like, Sandman and Lizard never had much to do with this story. I think they were forced in to begin with.
gotcha. All right.
I also think, don't underestimate the idea of, like, these actors doing a gig that their grandchildren can watch. Like, I think that's why Gary Oldman played Commissioner Gordon from a movie.
Oh,
I'm sure
they
wanted
to make
one movie that my granddaughter can see.
Oh yeah, no, I'm sure they want to do it. It's just I had the same thought when I, because they ran a trailer for Scream, the new Scream, mm-hmm. in front of Spider-Man. And again, this is, I'm not trying to insult anybody. It's just a statement of fact that when I was watching the Scream trailer and it's like Courtney Cox and Neve Campbell and David Arquette. And I'm like,
kind of a time capsule.
These three people would not headline a movie today. No, there's zero chance they would headline a movie, but to get them for Scream, it's a get. But it makes me wonder, well, how much pull do any of them have at this point to say, are they happy to be back? I don't know. Again, I'm not trying to make it be smart.
They have pull inside of those movies. But I mean, right. That is why they're coming. It's like the franchise isn't worth anything without them.
Right.
They exactly. know that. Right. And it's just like the same thing with this. It's like if you hadn't gotten these other actors to do it, you wouldn't have wanted to touch a multiverse story. You wouldn't have wanted to do anything like this. I think there was another entire Spider-Man 3 story planned for after this that was supposed to be Kraven, and I think it all just got cut. I think in service of doing something that nobody really thought they could pull off. And, you know, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, the Sony animated movie, it just proved that the audience isn't dumb and they can understand some large ideas.
I do want to see, like, know if, like, if Toby and Andrew had any reservations, or if it was a thing where it's like they'll only sign on if the other one does and they won't sign on first, so they have to be like signing on at like the exact same time and their lawyers are talking on the phones and there's like
they're all pointing their pens at one another. You go first. Okay, now I think we can all agree it's about as close to a statement of fact that an opinion can be that J.K. Simmons is just great in everything he appears in at this point. I mean, he's just
that's a fact. Yeah.
Yeah. He shows up in the Being the Ricardos movie about Lucy, which we covered over on Fade Out a couple of weeks ago. He shows up as William Frawley, Fred Mertz, and he's the best thing in it. And I mean, I even kind of like that movie, but he is just a live wire. And so I loved him in this. I think he's great. I love that they completely turn him into Alex Jones. I love that J. Jonah Jameson is selling supplements. That's just, that was such a direct shot at that walking turd, Alex Jones, that I really appreciated that Marvel got that shot in there. So I love J.K. Simmons in this. It's just great. He's just such a jolt of energy.
And they set him up in this. I mean, I hope they're going to do something, but the way they end this movie, and, you know, as we were talking about before, where it just kind of reboots him at the end, which is just great. And we're going to, you know, kind of take a step backwards from the Avengers Spider-Man and get more to the bare bones Spider-Man. And they kind of put J. Jonah Jameson in perfectly in the story now. Mm-hmm. It's like you see where this hypothetically will go for whatever Spider-Man movie they do next. And you see how Peter's going to end up with a job, you know, at the Daily Bugle.
Yep.
Which is amazing that we're not even going to get that until we're at like the fourth Spider-Man movie. The seventh movie with Spider-Man in it in the like Civil War. I mean, in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But it works really, really well. And it's like, yeah, look, that whole thing, they like did Spider-Man backwards, basically. They gave Spider-Man all his big action, like outer space stuff, like early in the series. And now we're going to go back to I made my own costume in my apartment, Spider-Man.
It's the Casino Royale of Spider-Man movies. It's back to the really grim basics. So
it kind of works, though, if you think of the Avengers era of Tom Holland's Peter Parker as his celebrity status, then it kind of does work. Like it's those couple of pages in Amazing Fantasy 15 that shows Spider-Man as a TV sensation. And then, you know, and then like tragedy strikes and with great power comes great responsibility. And then he becomes a street level crime fighter, you know? So I guess you can kind of look at it working that way. 'Cause he definitely was, obviously he was the most famous person in the world, as he said at one point in this movie. So it does kind of work. And then now nobody knows him, because that seemed to be literally what happened to Spider-Man in the comics. It showed him on all these TV shows. And unless they did an origin flashback, they never mentioned his celebrity status ever again. So it kind of works.
Chris, that's a perfect segue to what I wanted to also ask about. So what did we all think of Aunt May buying it? I mean, I know for them to set up Spider-Man the way they wanted to, they stripped everything away from him, but that doesn't necessarily make it palatable. What did we all think about the loss of...
I think Aunt May makes the movie. I think that... I thought it was incredible, actually. I thought it was incredible that we got, like, her last line of the film is, with great power comes great responsibility. And I can't believe that you got that into a Spider-Man movie without me thinking how fucking stupid it would be to hear somebody say that. And it just kind of worked so nicely. And then the fact that it's Andrew Garfield, Tobey Maguire, everybody else, they're not just cameos. All of these characters actually have a purpose and they have an arc. And their characters become, like, their three characters come together over this, over, Mary Jane brings those two guys to Peter. So he can have somebody to talk to about the fact that he just lost the most important person in his life to him. And he's as alone as he could be in this moment. And that's where we basically get him and, you know, Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire having their first scene together. And because of it, it's a beautiful scene. It's something that really shouldn't work. And it works really, really well. So I thought Aunt May couldn't have been a more beautiful thing to have happen. And for her to get killed by William Dafoe, by the Green Goblin, like, made it very special, because it ties back into Toby's moment at the end of the movie then. I mean, anyway, I thought it was like a brilliant little piece. I don't know would the movie would have worked had that not happened.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that, you know, just because Marissa Tomei is Marissa Tomei and she's so full of life in everything she's in, and her Aunt May was just so energetic and so positive. She wasn't the, you know, the doddering old Aunt May, although they never made none of the Aunt Mays in the movies were the pain in the ass that the comic book Aunt May often was.
Right.
They weren't the, you know, the limp dish rag that, you know, just was, you know, just constantly like feigning and, you know, making wheat cakes. But she, you know, Marissa Tomei just being her, just the fact that she was Peter's moral compass, you know, no, this is your responsibility. Like, they're here because of you. And she did, even in the moment when she's dying, she, you know, and what had happened, she told him, you know, you got to stay the course. This is the right thing to do. I mean, it was a beautiful moment. And I mean, it was really, I was really kind of surprised when they cut back and showed her body and that tear running down her face. I mean, she'd long been dead. Spider-Man had, they'd shot at him, he'd left, they'd arrested Happy, you know, and it was just kind of really like, like, no, there's no coming back from this. Aunt May's dead. And that kind of cemented it. That was kind of bold, I think, that to put that in this light, otherwise light, frothy Spider-Man film, because these films have been rather, you know, light and frothy, even for the MCU. But it really worked. And like you said, it set that connection up between the Peter Parkers, and them reaching out to him in that moment. It meant so much when they all come across the sage wisdom. Now, does that mean they're, you know, was there an Uncle Ben that died? I mean, you know, he's got luggage in Far From Home that says, you know, I think it's BFP. So I guess Benjamin Franklin Parker. So I don't know where there's an Uncle Ben maybe somewhere, but yeah, obviously Peter's Uncle Ben is his Aunt May in this universe. And I thought it was great.
Ryan, what'd you think?
Her death was necessary for two reasons. The first of which, and I credit Nathaniel Wayne pointed this out on his reaction video, by the end of the movie, when Strange does put out the spell that the whole world, everyone forgets who Peter Parker is and that he's Spider-Man. If Aunt May is still alive and she forgets her surrogate son, essentially, that's cruel. That's not just sad and unfortunate, that's cruel and kind of mean-spirited on the movie's take. So that can't be a loose end in the movie. So there, that was just a function of the story that had to be. But also goes back to everything that Chris and Corey said, and kind of what I was saying is this Spider-Man needed that Uncle Ben moment. He needed that Uncle Ben touch. And maybe he had an Uncle Ben who left Aunt May. Why would you leave Marissa Tomei? I can't imagine. Or he died some other way. We don't know. But he didn't have the crystallizing, defining moment in Peter Parker's life, which is Peter's actions or inactions, however you look at it, lead to the death of the person who was like a parent to him more than anything else in the world. And he has to learn from that, and he has to make better, smarter, more humane choices because of that. And in the other origin movies, you get that from Uncle Ben. This one, just because of the way they tried to jigger Spider-Man into a pre-established MCU, they went a different track, but they get to it eventually. And I just love the fact that they did use Aunt May as that, because Aunt May is kind of a thankless role. She's a constant in Peter's life, but she never feels as important. She feels like baggage that he has to deal with and will never be as fondly thought of and remembered as Uncle Ben, that image from the comics of just his face in the clouds when Peter remembers the important part he has. Like, now he has that. And Corey was right. Like, it's the thing that unites all of these Spider-Men. It's how they come together. It's how they snap him out of his darkness, because he's in the bleakest, most dangerous position he's ever been in. And these other Peters are like, no, we have been. And he's like, no, don't tell me you know what I'm going through. It's like, no, stop for a second. We actually exactly do know what you're going through, and this is how you come out the other end. Okay. It is beautiful. It was perfectly excellent. Yeah. So it was necessary, but it was also really powerfully done.
Yeah, I agree. If they had done the third act and no one remembers him, and even Aunt May forgets him, that would have been impossible to reconcile. You just would have been like, oh no, we can't do this. So yeah, and Marissa Tomei can always come back in flashbacks or whatever, because you don't need to de-age her. She doesn't age, so you can just keep bring her back into the movie. She can play the same age no matter what. So okay, well that leads perfectly to the third act. And I will say, going into this movie, I knew it was spoiled for me. I knew that Garfield and McGuire showed up. I knew they were going to be in it. I did not know to the extent that they were going to be in it. And when they showed up, first of all, I saw it on Tuesday night, the first Tuesday after it premiered on Friday. So it was like 5 days in. So the crowd that I saw it with, obviously a lot of them had not seen it yet and didn't know, because there were two young women in the row in front of me. And when MJ and Ned opened the portal and we see Spider-Man, and they're like, hey, Peter. And he jumps in and he pulls the mask off, and it's Andrew Garfield. these two young women screamed with delight. Like, they clearly did not know that was coming. And it was so beautiful to hear. You know, it was just so genuine that this movie had pulled this surprise on at least these two audience members that I found it just to be so charming. They're like, oh my God, they pulled this off. I will say, I was impressed how much Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire figure into the third act, because I thought it was going to be like a cameo. Like, it's going to be like a glorified cameo. It'll be nice to see them, and then they'll shuffle off. No, this movie does, I mean, this movie leaves nothing left on the table in terms of what you want to get out from seeing three Spider-Men together. I always thought deep down, I swear to God, I went until like the last 10 minutes of Rise of Skywalker thinking there's no way they're going to close out this trilogy without Han, Luke, and Leia all together, right? They filmed that at some point, right? They must have. There's no way they whiffed that. And then the credits roll, and I went, oh my God, they really did. We're really not going to get Han, Luke, and Leia. They had them all. They didn't put them together for 2 minutes? And I was disappointed in that. You know, even though it would have been, you know, whatever, how are you would have, yeah, Jerry rigged it would have been to get that. But I really thought they bothered to get Garfield and Maguire. And to me, they covered everything you'd want to see them cover, everything. And I was really impressed by that the three of them got so much, they got some funny bits to do. They literally got to recreate the meme, the Spider-Man meme, which was amazing. I mean, and just like the whole crack your back thing. And mm-hmm. Oh, the web shoot that comes out of your wrist, does it come out of anywhere else? Like, it really felt like they were like, they once they secured those actors, I feel like they set, like Kenny, we were talking about earlier, Corey, we're like, I feel like they had the script and then they signed those two, and then they almost did like a separate story session and said, what is everything people want to see? From this
I mean,
moment.
It feels very improv-y, the stuff between Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire. I feel like those guys were just having fun, and they probably made up a lot of that stuff, and it made it into the movie. Or they just kind of made it up, and then it became part of the script as they kept rehearsing it. But it just felt so casual that I was like, I don't think somebody could have written this dialogue. I feel like they were just fooling around because it felt just so natural and was so good, Rob. And by the way, like those two girls in the theater that just cheered when they saw Andrew Garfield, it's like, how did they not know he was in the movie? This is my big thing with this movie, with a lot of movies these days, where I'm like, do you know how excited I would have actually been for this movie if the only stuff they showed us in the trailer was like him and Doctor Strange, and they didn't show any of the Sinister Six, they didn't hint at the other Spider-Mans, and then this entire time this movie would have been happening, I would have been like those two girls, I would have been hooting in my seat throughout the entire movie. I was excited, I was so happy to see all of those people, but like I would have been so excited if I didn't know. And I almost feel like the marketing of the movie did not depend on that. Like, everybody would have still come to see this movie if it hadn't been marketed with, you know, Alfred Molina coming back and William Dafoe and whoever else. So, because I'm just like, how, while they did keep Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire a secret from the trailers until the movie came out, it's like, if they hadn't been in the movie, the audience would have rioted.
Yeah.
And Andrew Garfield straight up lied in interviews.
Yeah.
He was asked. He straight up lied and said, no, I'm not in it. I mean, hats off to him. What's he going to do? Go to movie jail? I mean, what's the difference?
I felt so sorry for Andrew Garfield because he's out promoting a movie, you know, and another movie. And everywhere he went, no one wanted to talk about his movie. They wanted to ask him, "What, are you in Spider-Man?" And how did the guy, why put that poor guy in that position? You know, I mean,
he's having the best year of his life. Are you kidding?
I know he is now, but I mean, at the same time, that had to be frustrating as hell. You know, I mean, I felt sorry for him, but I, you're totally right. People, if one being my son, if those two guys hadn't been in this movie, after all those supposed leaks and all those leaks set, and I have to, are they, not to get into conspiracy theories here, but were they actual real leaks, or did Sony leak them to just make this a hype machine for this movie. I don't know. I mean, there's so many leaked photos that have been out for so long, and they were right. They were true photos. They weren't doctored. They were on set photos because we can now match them to the scenes in the film. I don't know. I don't know if it was like on purpose or it really was a leak. I kind of almost feel like it was on purpose now because the hype machine was just so insane for this movie. But if those guys, two guys, hadn't showed up, there would have been riots in the streets.
Riots.
I would not feel sorry for Andrew Garfield or Tobey Maguire because, A, they get to be the darlings of the online fan community that loves them so much and is so happy that these guys are back. And B, they don't have to do the press junket for the movie and answer all, and sit down for 50 interview questions a day or 50 interviews a day for like within the same thing. So
that's such a good point.
They can skip out on that part. I think they're okay.
That's true. That's true. And I'm sure they unloaded a dump truck of money at each of their houses too. You know, so I mean, it's yeah, it, but yeah, when they jumped through, when as soon my, of course, Andrew like gave me a bruise on my elbow as soon as you saw the lenses of Andrew Garfield's mask, which are huge, you know, in that alleyway, he was elbowing me and people were, oh my God. And the crowd was just getting really, you know, and when he jumped through, he didn't have to take his mask off yet. They knew it was him by his frame and his costume. You know, he's the lanky, tall Spider-Man, right? So everybody went nuts. And then when Toby come in, everybody went nuts. And I mean, it was just, and it just was just great. And like you said, Corey, I mean, everything, the only thing I really do wish is that J. Jonah Jameson had been like on a boat somewhere in the harbor by the statue, you know, reporting live, and Toby went by and webbed his mouth shut. That's the only thing.
He's so good. You didn't miss him in the movie, but like his character didn't belong in the movie much more than it was. And it was a great use of the character, right, and kind of a great use to the device of the multiverse. When we first snuck Jonah Jameson in and the tag of the last Spider-Man movie, yeah, you know, that he was the first actor. By the way, he is the only person in the multiverse that looks like everybody in the multiverse, I guess. except he doesn't have hair in this version of the multiverse.
Right.
But yeah, that would have been hysterical, Chris, to have J. Jonah be like, three Spider-Men! You know, like that, you know, like, oh my God, I'm so much worse. Yeah. I was as the third act rolled on and they had so much to do, I just sat there and I went, this is impressive. This is the Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire are not just, I mean, look, they're cashing checks, obviously, but they're not just doing it. They're actually really delivering. They're clearly into it. You can almost see the joy in their faces that they get to kind of be Spider-Man again and kind of get these victory laps, which is really fun.
It was so cool.
Well, you see, babyface Tobey Maguire actually played the elder statesman in a way, who's got like this kind of like responsibility and hints at the fact that maybe, you know what, maybe he has a family life. Maybe he kind of like succeeded and got that little happy ending. The fact that, you know, like Andrew Garfield has kind of like this existential crisis and he's able to say, no, you're amazing. You're amazing. Like kind of like bucking him up and giving him the pep talk that he's always needed because he's like always like the underachieving Spider-Man of the three because he didn't get in as much movies and his kind of like legs were taken out from under him and all this stuff going on. And yeah, Corey, you're right. Like it was something you mentioned earlier. Like it's not just bringing these characters into this multiverse, but functioning as a sequel, not just to the Tom Holland Spider-Man movies, but this is now functions as a sequel to the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movies because it's building on that continuity and that character lived on and had other adventures and giving the Andrew Garfield character a second chance and a redemption arc after his calamitous failure at the end of his last movie. So being able to build them and restore them and rejuvenate them in ways that it just feels that's the fan service-y that really, really works because it's not just emotional, nostalgic like fan service. It actually has a story point when you look at a broader kind of meta picture to the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it goes against what we think fan service means these days. Fan service means like, fan service is what the CW has done, like on all of their shows. They give you fan service where they give you a hint of something that you always wanted to see and you're like, oh, that's really cool. Thank you for acknowledging that. And this just took it a whole step further. It's not fan service. These are characters in the story that need to be there in order for the story to ultimately work. And I mean, look, Sony owns the rights to Spider-Man still, and it's going to never not own the rights to Spider-Man unless it gets bought by Marvel entirely or Disney, which is totally possible. But
everything will be bought by Disney eventually. The government eventually will be bought by Disney.
It would have been easier if they didn't have three hits this year.
Seriously. We're going to see, I think we're going to see these guys come back now. I think that there's not a reason not to make another Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movie or another Andrew Garfield movie. There's no reason that Sony can launch their own Spider-Verse right now, and they can make it as big as Marvel's Marvel-Verse if they want to. They could have I'm sure they're building up to like a Spider-Gwen movie or a Gwenpool movie. And this is when you start getting into some really obscure kind of like multi-dimensional characters. But hey, why not? If it worked, if you could put all of this in one movie, why not? Why not keep telling one Spider-Man story in one direction and another Spider-Man story in another direction? If they can make money, I think they will. So, I mean, I mean, people would pay a lot of money, I think, to go see Tobey Maguire star in another Spider-Man movie, which is totally bizarre, but they would.
A great way to introduce Spider-Girl. If Toby's got Mayday, Kirsten Dunst have Mayday Parker somewhere. What a great way to introduce Spider-Girl. I was kind of wondering if there wouldn't be a little end scene like that. No offense to Venom fans, but I'd rather have that than the Venom scene. But you know, that's me. But
you guys have, well, all right. Did you guys have a particular favorite moment with the three Spider-Mans? And mine was the gag, which was the Avengers, and then the beat. Great. Who are they? What is that? I just thought that was so, it's a great joke. It's a great meta joke, and that it's kind of like that Toby and poor Andrew Garfield didn't get the benefit of the greater Marvel universe. And it's, I mean, Garfield missed it by that much, you know. I just thought that joke was fantastic, of just the beat.
And then he says like, ooh, is that a band?
Yeah. Are you a band? Yeah. That just made me laugh so hard. But so, I mean, Chris, let me start with you. Do you have like, out of all the moments, did you have one that you thought was your absolute favorite?
I love the meta back comment from Toby, because he hurt his back filming Seabiscuit. He almost didn't come back for Spider-Man 2 to possibly be replaced by Jake Gyllenhaal, who started this whole mess anyway as Mysterio. So how meta is that? And the fact that they did the whole my back thing in Spider-Man 2 when he fell, when his powers were, you know, going out. And I also just love the fact that, you know, Andrew was so happy that he fixed his back. He's got his arms out for like an extra like minute. Like, like I just Andrew Garfield just so damn, I mean, I love Toby too, but Andrew Garfield just so damn fun as and he's the poor beaten down Spider-Man in a lot of ways. He is the underdog. He's Spider-Man 3. I'm Spider-Man 3, you know.
He's the scene stealer. He really stole his scenes. Yeah.
He did. And I'm down for separate Spider-Man movies for both those guys. Bring them back in their own spot. I watch all three Spider-Man guys in their own separate movies. Bring them back together. But yeah, the back thing was my favorite.
Ryan?
I talked to Shag and a few other people, and I think a lot of us were all in agreement that I think the funniest gag was Garfield asking Toby, are you going to go into battle dressed as the cool youth pastor? But the emotional climax when Andrew Garfield's Peter Parker catches MJ, when you see her falling, and it looks like it's shot almost the same way as the Amazing Spider-Man 2 thing, when she's going down and Tom Holland is reaching for her and it gets taken out by the Goblin, but Garfield is able to swing down and catch her and lower her down safely, and he asks if she's okay, and she's like, yeah, and she has that beat, and she's like, are you okay? And you see him like, not even able to hold the tears back. He's like, I'm going through some stuff right now. It's just that moment was really special. And yeah, to the other question that's sort of been going around, like I thought a great idea. Like, if you need to do Toby, if you need to bring him back again, I don't know that I need another whole Spider-Man movie with him, but if he was the father of Spider-Girl, that could be cool. Andrew Garfield, like, if he was the Spider-Man of the Venom universe and they bring him back for like Venom 3 or something like that, and he gets to play in that realm while Tom Holland remains the MCU, like, official Spider-Man, I would be fine with that. Like, to compare all three of them, I think Andrew Garfield was always my favorite Spider-Man in costume. I think he felt the most at home. He was very comfortable. He was very funny. He just kind of had brought this energy that made me feel like Spider-Man. But I thought his Peter Parker was a little bit too cool to be Peter Parker. Like, he was the kind of guy that everybody would want to hang out with. And I was like, that's not Peter. Peter's like kind of a social outcast, a little bit more of a misfit and a nerd. Toby, I always thought, had a really good handle on that aspect of Peter Parker, and there was the biggest distinction between his portrayal of Peter and his portrayal of Spider-Man. But his Spider-Man wasn't as funny and didn't have the quips that I really associate with character. Tom Holland is sort of a synthesis of a lot of those, and I think benefits from just having the best material, the best scripts, the funniest, the smartest, and things like that, and is able to learn from those things. But I kind of feel like there's almost no distinction between who he is when he's wearing the costume and who he is when he's not. And hopefully, maybe, that distinction will become more clear going forward because of the whole drastic shakeup to his status quo. But yeah, I think all of them are great. I would like to see, I loved seeing this. I don't need to see more of them, but I would enjoy seeing more of all of them, but we'll see.
Corey, your favorite moment of the three?
Oh, I think we already talked about it, but I definitely love when they start talking about his web shooters being organic. Because that was always such a, like, I remember that so clearly when I saw Spider-Man in the theater. It was like one of the things that, like, I remember having to reconcile with. Was like, he's got organic web shooters. And I remember like reading an article or something at the time about Sam Raimi talking about how he just wanted to make Peter Parker more relatable and not have him be some super scientist who made, you know, web slingers, but somebody who was just relatable as a high school kid. And the fact that that all kind of now is somehow part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe is, yeah, it's just really cool. I think it's really cool. Mm. So, yeah. That was pretty funny.
You know, Ryan, you mentioned Venom. I have not seen either of the Venom movies. I was never a Venom guy. He came of age in the 90s when I was reading comics, and I just was like, eh. So I have no interest in the two movies. And then, of course, there's the mid-credit scene featuring Venom. And I walked away from that mid-credit scene going, if that's what the Venom movies are like, I never need to see the Venom movie. Because I was like, is that the whole movie? It's just Tom, what's his name?
Tom Hardy.
It's just Tom Hardy and then a guy going, I'm like, that's the movie? That's all 2 hours of these movies? I was like, hard pass.
I haven't seen the Venom movies either, but I'm excited about the idea that it's going to be brought in. I'm excited that Tobey Maguire Spider-Man references Venom to Tom Holland in the movie at one point. He asks him, like, what is
crazy
villain? Yeah. And he's like, oh, I fought this, like, gooey, black gooey alien once.
I mean, I knew it was coming, but I didn't know the level of how obnoxious the Venom thing was in these movies, and I'm like, if that's what this is, I never need to track down those two films. I'm good.
I'm right there with you. I haven't seen either of the Venom movies. I really wasn't interested in, but the praise that I've heard from them feels very dubious. I thought that mid-credit scene was really stupid and quite obviously forced upon the movie by Sony.
That forced upon the movie, or was that always because it's like he's the sixth person of this Sinister Six? There was always this idea that there was a sixth character they were hiding from us that they don't really.
Sony's the one that's been trying to make a Sinister Six movie for like a decade, including trying to make a Sinister Six movie without Spider-Man.
Right.
I definitely think that was really their thing, and yeah, like. At this point, the only thing that could make me interested in a Venom movie is if Andrew Garfield showed up in the Spider-Man costume in that movie. Like, maybe that would get it, but yeah, I don't know. And I really curious about the ramifications that now there's part of the symbiote in the MCU. Like, that was a trade-off that Marvel got somehow, and I don't know what they're going to do with it, because I can't imagine they can make their own Venom movie.
They'll give Spider-Man the suit. They'll get him black suit the way that it is in the comic books. He won't have a fancy Iron Man suit anymore. So when he needs to go to like fight Secret Wars, they'll.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Chris.
I was going to say, I saw the first Venom film. I haven't seen the second one. I enjoyed it more than I thought I would. I basically went and saw it because Andrew wanted to see it. And, It actually, you know, it for what it is, it was fun. He told me himself he's seen the second. He didn't like it nearly as well. The second one, there is a end credit scene that sets up his appearance in this film, but they sure didn't do much with it other than him basically dropping off the little blip of the symbiote on that bar counter. So yeah.
I just didn't know that Venom sounded like Fang from the Soupy Sales Show. I just didn't know that was their that was their take on it. But yeah. Okay.
Would you have been better if Topher Grace had showed up
cameo
his role?
You know what? I want the sixth villain to be Molten Man. All right. I know I'm alone on that, but I want it to be Molten Man. So, okay. That again, you guys must have seen my notes because you keep coming up with these great segues. The reason I was so unimpressed with the two previous Spider-Man movies is that they made him to me too much like Iron Man, is that they just gave him these tech suits that can do anything. And I'm like, and I felt a little bit that way about Black Panther, that it was like, you know, all of a sudden, like in the comics, Black Panther just was like a guy in a regular cloth costume. And all of a sudden he's got like tech gear that can do anything. And Spider-Man is like, oh, he's got arms that can come out and he's got like force shields and what, you know, why not missiles? I mean, fractal tech gear. I mean, what? And I understand why they do that, because now that there's no, first of all, it's an easy thing for scriptwriters to just say, oh, the suit can do it. And secondly, with Iron Man out off the table, you need a new kind of Iron Man. So I understand. But there was a part of me that was like, that's not Spider-Man. This is a different thing. This is not that. And the fact that this movie ends with the Spider-Man that I want to see, which is lonely, hard scrabble, making it with a sewing machine Spider-Man, that makes me more eager for Spider-Man 4 than I ever would have imagined I would have been. Because I'm like, now I'm on board. I'm like, oh yeah, let's see. I want to see this Tom Holland working at the Daily Bugle and struggling to pay his bills and leaning up against the side of a building, eating a sandwich with his mask up over his mouth. That's the Spider-Man. It's
much
I
more
see.
When they bring Kraven into this story eventually. And I think that we'll get a Tom Holland Kraven movie. It's like, how not fun would it be to see Kraven going after Spider-Man in a high-tech suit, you know? Like,
they've spoilers for Hawkeye, they brought Kingpin into this world, so now he can, like, we can have a whole gang war thing with Kingpin and Hammerhead and Silvermane.
That street level happening. It's awesome.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yep. Daredevil's going to be part. It's so cool.
I didn't like the Netflix shows, any of them. I watched each of them less than... Each show I watched less than the one before it. I watched like a whole season of Daredevil and then like half a season of Luke Cage and like two episodes of Iron Fist and none of Defenders. Like each show got less interesting to me. And I was kind of on board with saying, you know what? Let's just cut that arm off. They're not part of the MCU. Like that was an experiment. Didn't work. Forget it. But once I saw Charlie Cox show up as Daredevil, I forgave all. I was like, No, I like that it's him. I like that it's him. And I love that, spoiler, that Kingpin shows up in Hawkeye. I'm on board with this. And I'm like, no. Give all those actors. Get them all in. Let's not make them the redheaded stepchild. Let's bring them all in. I thought that was great.
Rob, a little bird told me once that it's like, I think that the, Marvel really loved that Daredevil show on Netflix. And it wasn't so well received. The other shows were not so well received by people at Marvel, right? Yeah. So I think they might try to kind of forget about most of the Netflix stuff, but Charlie Cox and anything that happened in Daredevil remains. I think John Berthenol, whatever his name is, who played Punisher.
Punisher, yeah.
I think I think he might manage to stay around, but we might get reboots on those other characters eventually. Luke Cage.
I think Jessica Jones might be a little too much for the Disney part of Marvel to want to deal much with her. She's also kind of already told her most important story. I think changes were made to the lore of Shang-Chi to basically make him Iron Fist, so they don't need to bring Iron Fist back. What they do with Luke Cage, I have no idea. But Rob, I was with you in that. I was watching less and less of the shows as they went along. But I finally decided, I was like, because I knew the rumors of these characters coming back were in the wind. So I finally went and watched the third season of Daredevil. And I loved it. I just start to finish that as a whole arc. That season is terrific. And that season sold me on Charlie Cox. Because I was kind of the opinion, I was like, he was fine, but he didn't necessarily do anything that another great actor couldn't do as Matt Murdock. But after watching the third season, I was like, no, I want him to stick around. So I am glad that he gets to play that character going forward. So I'm excited to see. I assume we will see him in She-Hulk next, because why wouldn't you have two lawyers? There are only so many lawyers in the world.
I really enjoyed the first two seasons of Daredevil. I haven't watched the third, basically, because I tried getting into Defenders, and I watched some of Luke Cage. I watched like one episode of, and it was nothing against Luke Cage. I like that fine, but I just didn't watch the rest of it. Iron Fist, I watched like one episode and I was kind of eh. Jessica Jones, I just didn't feel like a real connection to. But I did try to watch the first few episodes of Defenders, and like, I only care about Daredevil in this show. So,
you don't even need to finish it. I watched one episode of Defenders and I didn't care, and I skipped it. You don't need it for season three. You'll be able to catch up after 5 minutes. And
I only watched one episode of Defenders too. So I could watch Daredevil 3 and it doesn't matter. I don't need
you,
to.
You're familiar with comics. You know what a recap page is. They explain what's going on. Well, everything you need to know is in the first 5 minutes. And then you just jump in and just basically forget everything that happened.
Cool. So. Well, I'll watch Daredevil season three now then. Cool.
Yeah. It's good.
I was happy to see Charlie. I don't want any of the, now that they've shown that they can do this, that they can do something. Marvel keeps coming up with ways to do something I didn't think they could do. Cause like Infinity War/Endgame did something. I was like, wow, they literally just folded all 20 movies into one movie, which I just didn't think was possible. And then with this, they're like, okay, we're now expanding out to incorporate other franchises, which I didn't think was. Now, of course, we know DC's doing that too, but you know, I mean, unfortunately, I think to a lot of movie fans, they'll be like, well, Marvel already did this. You know, I mean, yeah. I'm excited.
God, DC has got to get on top of their game. It's like,
I mean, I'm excited to see Michael Keaton Batman show up again, no doubt. But at the same time, it's like, well, Marvel just kind of did that already, guys. You know, it's a little like kind of stole
makes the, it a little less thunder. Exciting. It's true. Yeah, it's, right. it's when yeah. Justice League came out, like what? Like a few months after Infinity War came out, it was like, I was like, oh, this movie can't possibly excite me now.
But yeah, I mean, so Marvel really, again, I didn't think that was possible to just, to extend that goodwill and just working out the legal clearances of all of those things. It just had to be, and scheduling and getting Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield to show up and just commit to it as much as they did. It was just really amazing.
All of those guys, Rob, it's like that actually, it's like, it's on par with like that funeral scene in Avengers Endgame where all those actors showed up. It's like, there was a lot of heavy hitters who all needed to be present on the same days for Spider-Man 3. That's a ton of movie stars in that.
Unreal. So, all right, we should wrap it up here. We've been talking for a while. So as we end the show, I want to get everybody's sort of final thoughts on either this movie or the Spider-Man franchise or just anything you want to talk about related to Spider-Man in the movies. I'll give you all time to think about. So I will go first. Like I said, I am more excited for Spider-Man 4 than I ever would have thought I would have been, because I just thought, okay, based on the three, it's going to be more Spider-Man in fractal tech gear, and I don't care about that. And the fact that they rebooted it, but rebooted it in a way that he still gets to be Spider-Man and he still gets to interact with the MCU is really impressive. And that final sequence, the final scene of him swinging in the absolutely perfect red and blue suit. I mean, the 100% saturated colors of the Spider-Man suit just made me say, oh man, let's get Spider-Man 4 on the docket as soon as possible. And I am very frustrated that supposedly in the clouds, when Doctor Strange is like trying to repair the whole fabric of the universe, that Scorpion and Kraven can be seen, but I missed it. I feel really bad that I didn't see that. I feel like I'm good at that thing, but I must be getting older. I am really, really excited. And I hope that in somewhere in Spider-Man 4, they work in the Spider-Mobile. So that's my final comment for the Spider-Man movie. So, Ryan, why don't you go? What's your sort of big summing up with the Spider-Man 3 or these movies?
I've seen superhero movies where I really, really love the first two acts of the movie, and then the last act kind of tanked it a little bit for me. I'm thinking of Wonder Woman, and I'm thinking of the second Wolverine movie. This one was kind of the opposite, where, like I was saying, I'm sort of entertained just because these characters are familiar and I like the banter and everything like that. But like, I really thought the first hour of this movie was pretty shaky. And then it just hits this point where it's like, we're just going to throw all of this crazy stuff in at you and just let it vibe on its own little frequency. And the last act, like the last half of the movie, is just so fun and speaks to Spider-Man in a way that sort of the Spider-Verse did, where it just embraces all aspects of this character's past, present, and future in this kind of silly way. That's kind of a love letter to the character in all of his incarnations and all of his fandoms, and celebrates people who like a particular Spider-Man more than another, get to see themselves and what can be hinted at in the future. So I'm really excited for where they go. I think the fourth movie could be better than any of these, just because of it might be more of a resetting of the Spider-Man that we kind of know and love from the comics and what feels familiar. But knowing them, they'll take it in kind of crazy direction. I also don't let anybody sleep on, we are getting Across the Multiverse, or Across the Spider-Verse Part 1 in a year from now, because we got more animated adventures of Miles Morales and those guys coming up. Because my favorite Spider-Man movie is still Into the Spider-Verse, the animated one. So I'm looking forward to the sequel to that one coming up next.
I love that line of Electro's. I thought there'd be a black Spider-Man. Man. Yeah.
You help people.
It's great.
Andrew Garfield's just like, oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Chris, final thoughts?
There was so much hype for this movie in my household. I never thought it could actually live up to it. But it did for both myself and for Andrew. You guys know, I mean, Andrew cosplayed as Tom Holland's Spider-Man when we were at Heroes Con, right? So you know how much
he was a Spider-Man. Damn good-looking Spider-Man. he looked really good.
Yeah, he did. That was a good suit. Yeah, and he pulled it off. And he went around with other Spider-Man at the con. It was cool. So they kind of did this movie before, if you think about it. I love this movie so much, it sent me to atrial fibrillation. I actually, coming home from this movie, I had to go to the hospital. And I was in the hospital for a few days after. And we all had a lot of fun with that, including my doctor, who said, I know this movie was good, but I don't know if it was that good. But no, it is that good. It actually set my heart aflutter. I'm not kidding. That's really happened. And I'm okay, guys, just in case listeners, I'm okay. I'm okay now. It really did, deliver on the impossible hype that was there. And I got to agree with Ryan. It was like the ultimate love letter to the character of Spider-Man. I mean, it was just like, let's take everything that's been done with Spider-Man on film, and if it wasn't done just quite right, let's fix it. And they made it all work. It's just, it is insane that it works. It shouldn't work. It's a testament to Kevin Feige and the Marvel machine, and to John Watts, the director, and to the screenwriters and all everyone involved. And it really, really makes me feel good about John Watts being in charge of this Fantastic Four movie. I'm super hyped for him to be involved with it, to him to take, because I think he'll keep some of that, he'll have that adventurous, fun, you know, light touch to it, without making it a total comedy as well, of course. But I'm really looking forward to see what he does with the Fantastic Four.
Absolutely. So, Corey?
I mean, I agree with everything everybody is saying here. I
I'm really excited about where this is leaving us now, and more Spider-Man movies now with this kind of soft reboot of Spider-Man. It's totally exciting. The movie exceeded any of my expectations. I'm so shocked that they pulled it off. I thought it was so good. Spider-Man means so much to me, always has since I was a little kid, and through my journey in Hollywood. You know, when I graduated from college in like 2000, they were auditioning for Spider-Man, and my classmate, who's Joe Manganiello, got cast as Flash Thompson. And I remember being really, really excited. And I collected all of this stuff from the movie when it came out. Anytime they animated Joe in anything like a Mad magazine or something, I would buy it. Hmm. And so the way that this story connects actually is, when Spider-Man, Sam Raimi's Spider-Man 3 came out, the first Spider-Man 3, Joe Manganiello has a small cameo in that movie as Flash Thompson. He's like in the funeral scene at the end of the movie. And this is kind of before Joe had become more famous. Anybody listening, if you don't know who Joe Manganiello is, he is Deathstroke in the end credits of the Justice League movie, or in the Snyder Cut, he's got that strange scene with the Joker. And you might know him from True Blood. So anyway,
he's like the most ripped, like muscular and handsome power nerd in Hollywood, from what I understand.
Yeah, no, I mean, he made me feel pretty dorky looking when I was in college, let me tell you. Joe always looked like that. It's really funny. And me and Joe were always friends because he's a dork and I'm a dork, and that's how it worked. But like,
he's married to Sofia Vergara, right?
Yes.
They're going to create a race of super people. Clearly.
They're amazing people. They're wonderful people. They really are. Me and Joe have been very close since we were kids. I spent Thanksgiving at his house every year for years. It's a close connection. So when Spider-Man 3 came out, Joe is not really famous at this point, and he's barely in Spider-Man 3. And the premiere of the movie is happening in New York, in Queens, which is where I lived at the time. I lived in Astoria. And so the movie, the premiere is happening at Astoria Kaufman Theaters, which is like, I don't know, 5-minute walk from my apartment. Joe tells me on the phone that he can't go to the premiere. And he says, if you want to go, you just tell them that you're me, and they'll just give you my tickets. And I was like, yeah, okay. And I went to the theater, and I remember on my walk over there, like practicing how to spell Manganiello, because that was my big fear, was I was going to misspell his last name. And I got to the box office and I just said, yeah, I'm Joe Manganiello. And then the people are so funny. They were like, oh, Joe, we've been waiting for you. Here you are. Here are your tickets. And like, clearly nobody knew like who Joe was, because they didn't know who I was. They thought I was him. And so I go to see Spider-Man 3. I'm in like the movie theater. They've given him tickets. He's like in the very front row. So I'm sitting in like the very front row. I see Spider-Man 3. This is my very first movie premiere. I was so excited. I was like as excited as a human being could possibly be, that I didn't even notice that the movie sucked. And I thought it was like the greatest thing that I had ever seen in my life. I remember getting out of the theater and calling Joe up and being like, oh God, Joe, it's so good. This movie is so good. You don't get it. It's like great. And I was like, Tobey Maguire's got a dance scene in it. It's amazing. This is the best Spider-Man movie ever. And then like, yeah, I think we talked like a week later and he was like, why did you tell me the movie was so good? So I was like really, really excited now. I feel like I was going full circle now. I'm in the movie theater and I'm seeing Spider-Man 3 again this time. And this part of me really was hoping that Joe Manganiello was going to show up in this movie. I knew he really wasn't going to, but I was still hoping he would. But my hope is that one day me and Joe can go pitch to Sony and Kevin Feige, and we can pitch a Flash Thompson story from the Tobey Maguire Spider-Verse, where he multi-dimensional travels into the Marvel Universe probably to start some big problem, something like that.
In the comics, Flash Thompson has become Venom, and now like he could be the MCU variant of Flash Thompson who gets the new symbiote from
Venom. Oh, is that so? Flash Thompson is Venom now?
They've changed it, not anymore, but for like, yeah, maybe 10 years in the comics, Flash Thompson was Venom, like an agent of the government. Like basically he was like Snake Eyes with the Venom suit.
That's really ironic that you told that story, because I myself get into things by saying I'm Corey Musa. Really, like, yeah. I get into all sorts of stuff. I'm just like, I'm moving. Have you seen All Is Lost? And they're just like, yes, sir. And they stanchions come down and I get right in. It's perfect.
Oh, my God. The life that you live, Rob.
it's not my own. That's the best.
I got to move to New Jersey.
No one's ever said that before. No one will ever say it again. So, all right. Well, boys, thank you so much for doing this. I'm going to give you guys, you listeners, a peek behind the curtain. This is something Ryan and Chris and I have dealt with all the time. Every time, and I don't know if it's specific to Ryan knows what's coming. I don't know if it's specific to me or the network in general. I don't think we've road tested it with the other members. But every time I have called my shot in terms of reviewing a movie for the network before I see said movie, I end up hating the movie every single time. I always go, oh, I know I'm gonna love X movie, so let's already decide we're gonna review it. And then I see it and I go, oh God, I can't talk about that movie. That was terrible. I don't want to spend 90 minutes talking about a movie I hate. And I almost did that for Spider-Man because I was so sure I was going to like this one because I knew what was coming. And I was like, how am I not going to enjoy it? But I was like, no, I'm not going to say it out loud because that's going to ruin it. And I will say, after I saw it, I was mixed enough on it that I was like, I'm kind of glad I didn't call the shot because everyone loved it. And I didn't want to be like the shriveled pit and the peach cobbler and be like the one guy who's like, I didn't like it as much. I didn't want to do that. But then as time wore on, I liked it more and more. And then Corey, you suggested it and your enthusiasm for talking about it was so infectious that I pitched it to the other guys. And of course, Ryan and Chris jumped in and now we got to do it. And now I feel so much better having done it. So thank you all for participating, but I'm so glad I didn't say this out loud because it would have preemptively ruined the movie for me.
We didn't want this to go like Justice Society World War II. I mean,
oh, God.
Oh,
and
Lord.
The one we were supposed to do a Wonder Woman 84 episode, yep. Guys. We never did it because we all thought it sucked.
Yeah.
That's funny. I remember thinking, I wonder why they didn't cover Wonder Woman 84.
There you go. So again, thank you all for participating. Ryan and Chris, of course, everyone knows you can find their shows on the network. I can announce that Corey Musa will be playing Silvermane in Spider-Man 4. We can announce that. Very exciting. Corey's
you get
very
to become
shy.
The cyborg version. That would be awesome.
It's going to be great. It's just going to be Corey's head in a jar. So, of course, if you want to find back episodes of the Film and Water Podcast, go to the website, filmandwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. We're always talking movies on Twitter, at Film and Water Pod. You can find my other movie-related shows here on the network, Fade Out, Superman Movie Minute, Citizen Kane Minute. And if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. There you can unlock various rewards, one of which is a name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Gord Tolton, David S. Gutierrez, and Corey Musa for their support of the Film and Water Podcast. I very much appreciate it. So that's going to do it. We'll be back. I don't know. We'll be doing another Film and Water before you know it. But until then, that's a wrap.
Which one?
No, I don't care which one. Get them both.
That man's an imposter. That man is the imposter. There can't be two Spider-Men.
Let's take them both in.